Alex, he's your brother.
Brother? Why? Because he looks like me? I'm gonna change that. Because I'm gonna fuck up his face.
Twins who were separated at birth join forces as adults to get revenge on the gangsters who killed their parents. This week, we chat about Bernie Madoff's charity work, Jean-Claude Van Damme's resume, and Lindsay Lohan's British accent. We also chat about an upcoming Super Mario 3D Greatest Hits collection before finding out if Double Impact stands the test of time.
Time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. My name is Alan Noah.
And I'm James Brief. Hey, Alan, you know what's better than one podcast about Van Damme?
Two podcasts about Van Damme?
No, one podcast about one movie with two Van Dammes. That's more Van Dammes for your mileage.
I mean, podcasts don't really get mileage, do they?
Yeah, but watching this film, Double Impact from 1991, you got two Van Dammes in one film.
Well, you have one Van Damme in two roles in one film.
Multiple dimensions to each character, though. So really, he was playing seven or eight characters.
I mean, also, they're basically the same exact character. But we'll get into that in just a little bit. First off, let's geek out about some Nintendo news. Nintendo finally announced the thing that everyone knew they were going to announce. For Mario's 35th anniversary, there will be a Super Mario 3D All-Stars game for Switch with Super Mario 64, Super Mario Sunshine, and Super Mario Galaxy, all in one game, one cartridge if you buy it physically. We've talked before about rebuying games that you already own. For me, honestly, I already own all three of these games. I have the systems hooked up in my basement. I'm not going to rebuy it. I think it's a good deal. I was talking with my friend's son the other day, and he was like, Uncle Al, should I get it? And I was like, well, you've never played those games before, right? He's like, no. I'm like, well, then, yeah, you should get it. But for me, nah. What do you think? Are you going to get it?
Yeah, I think I will because there's one thing that's different about this game, and that's portable because it's the Nintendo Switch. And for another thing, I don't have an easy way to play Mario 64. I think I have it on Nintendo DS, but...
Same.
Right, but, you know, it's not the same. You want it on the big screen, then you want it on the small screen. I've been using the Switch for exactly that purpose, and it really is fun to put something like Tetris 99 on the big screen or small screen, or I played through an older game, Bioshock, and I was playing that kind of when I'd go outside, and I could play inside on the big screen. The Switch was very nice for pandemic, to make sure you got some sun if you were playing some video game in the middle of the day. I also have never played Super Mario Galaxy.
What?
I don't know what year it came out, but whatever year it came out was an incredibly difficult year for me in whatever medical part of education I was doing. This game, I guess, came out during the Wii, right?
Yeah. Mario Galaxy came out on Wii. It's phenomenal. And also, by the way, Super Mario Galaxy 2, that game was also amazing. I'm surprised that you missed that. Super Mario Galaxy, I'm pretty sure, was the first 3D Mario game that I ever got all 120 stars on. Like, I was like that committed to getting 100% completion on that game, and I did it.
Actually, it's a funny story. You know exactly when I got the game, right, Al?
Oh, right. We got it at the midnight release. Yeah, you and I went there. I remember that.
We actually went, Alan and I went to Nintendo World Store, and at midnight, there was this whole like countdown from 10. There was lines all around Rockefeller Center. There were these bouncing castles where you jump and you wear a Velcro suit, and you know, you jump onto another Velcro wall so you can stick to it. There was Mario walking around. There were these guys that were wearing, do you remember they were wearing like backpacks that had monitors over their head? So that you yes. could play Mario Galaxy. And then they had someone from Z100 that was tossing some t-shirts into the crowd. And we did get a couple t-shirts that night.
Yes, yes. I still have that Super Mario Galaxy t-shirt and the Super Mario Galaxy commemorative coin, actually. Yeah, that's a really fun game. And yeah, if you haven't played any of those three games, I'd say it's worth it to pick it up.
And the very underrated Super Mario Sunshine, which there are certain boards in the Sunshine game, you know, the ones that are called the retro levels. Those are some of the funnest levels I've ever played in Mario games. You know the ones I'm talking about in Sunshine, right?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. When you don't have the water pack and you just have to run and bounce around.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So yeah, if you don't have it or if you want the portability, it's going to be a great buy. They're going to kind of do like a Disney vault kind of thing. This thing is only going to be available maybe for like 6 months.
Yeah, which is dumb, I think. Like, you know, if they're selling the game and people like it, why put an end date to it? I don't really understand it. And there was a big Twitter backlash when they first announced it. It wouldn't shock me if they go back on that.
No, I disagree. During the GameCube era, you remember there was this very limited Zelda collector's series. And I think this is a Nintendo kind of thing. Remember, Nintendo's a different company. You know at some point they're going to sell a Nintendo 64 all-in-one system, just like they did for the NES and Super Nintendo. And that's going to be showcased by, you know, Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time and the original Smash Brothers and Mario Kart 64. They're definitely going to want a little separate. Like, that's going to be the only way, really, that most people can buy Mario 64.
It just seems like a silly thing to me, especially when you're releasing it digitally. You know, it's not like it's a physical limited collector's item.
I don't know, Alan, because for years, our entire childhood, Disney could have let you buy Snow White and The Little Mermaid on VHS and DVD as long as you wanted to at any time, and they could have made all that money. But for some reason, this, for a limited time only, you could buy it now until it's back in the vault. It always entices sales. They may be onto something, or maybe, Al, you should be the president of Nintendo.
Maybe. Earlier you mentioned Tetris 99. Another thing that Nintendo announced was Super Mario 35, which is sort of like a Tetris 99-esque kind of madcap Mario game. That looks like a lot of fun. Like, I'm really into that.
Yeah, these Battle Royale things, that is the era of video games that we're in right now. It's the Battle Royale era. And everything from PUBG to Fortnite and the Apex Legends and Tetris 99, which I finally beat. I won once.
Whoa!
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. And if anyone else wins, there's something that, that unlocks in the game. It's very fun.
You took a picture of it, I assume. You got a screenshot, right?
It's the first time I ever wanted to use that screenshot instead of accidentally hitting it instead of the home button. But yeah, it basically opens winners only Tetris 99 for only past winners. It's called Tetris 99 Invictus.
Ooh.
Yeah, so if anyone else does that, tweet us or send any message to Al. He loves messages.
I do, but you'll never see it.
And, you know, speaking of being a champion of Tetris 99, you know who was a champion kickboxer back in the day?
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
That is correct.
Yeah. So you wanted to watch this movie. This is a James pick, not surprisingly. Why did you pick this movie, James?
I remember this film having somewhat regular rotation on HBO back in the day. And I wanted to see it again. I remember even back in the day, thinking it was absolutely ridiculous. It's just something that was on because, you know, in case people forget, in the 90s, you know, there wasn't HBO 2, 3, 4, HBO Max, HBO Family. There was HBO. You know, HBO, there was the movie that was playing. So that's how I saw a lot of these random films. Like I mentioned earlier, I had seen Caddyshack 2 many times, even though I had never seen Caddyshack 1 growing up.
Yeah, by the way, my father was very upset to hear that. He called me and was like, tell James that he was wrong for only watching Caddyshack 2. I'm like, well, he knows that, but sure, I'll tell him.
I do. I acknowledge that. So yeah, let's get right into this film because, you know, this film, like a lot of the Jean-Claude Van Damme films, they're not really heavy on the plot.
What?
The gimmick is either like he's kickboxing in a kickboxing competition and the movie is called Kickboxer.
Wait, I'm sorry. You lost me.
Well, you know, then when he's kickboxing and he's a time cop, it's Time Cop. And when he's kickboxing in, you know, an arena where there's going to be a hockey tournament, you know, what do they call it?
Hockey tournament of death, kickboxing, Van Damme, punch movie.
You actually got one of the words. It was called Sudden Death.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so this one, the gimmick is there's not just one Jean-Claude Van Damme, there's two Jean-Claude Van Dammes. And the aforementioned Jean-Claude Van Damme, he stars as twin brothers Chad and Alex. And after their parents are murdered when they're babies, the twins are separated and they're raised apart. And 25 years later, which is a modern day of 1991, they reunite and take back the streets of Hong Kong from the triads to avenge their parents and kill a whole lot of bad guys. That's generally the plot of this film.
So I'm quite sure I did not see this in the theater. I may have seen it on home video. My stepdad and I watched a lot of Van Damme and Steven Seagal movies and just kind of action movies back in the 90s. I don't really remember this one. Was this a hit at the box office?
You know, if you remember from Time Cop, we talked about Van Damme having kind of peaked at this moment. And if you recall, one of the major studios had offered him like a four-picture deal and they were going to pay him like $15 million. Instead of saying yes to this, he like held out. He said he wanted like Schwarzenegger movie money and he wanted to get like $15 million per film. And then the studio said no. And that's kind of around where you stop seeing Van Damme. But the reason why the studios wanted to give him a, you know, a deal, four pictures for $15 million, was because, you know, he was in these low budget films that were consistently making money. This film had a $15 million budget. And it opened at number two with $7.5 million. So, you know, half of its budget in opening weekend. And at number one, this is 1991, Al, it was beaten by a Charlie Sheen comedy. Do you know what that would be?
I'm going to guess Hot Shots or Hot Shots Part Deux.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's Hot Shots. And this opened on August 9th, 1991. And it wound up with $30 million domestically. And there's not really numbers about international, but you got to assume after, you know, doubling the budget, and we definitely did not see it in the theater. And the fact that we both, you know, kind of came across all these Van Damme films, they were all pretty profitable is what I have to assume. And, you know, this was one of those. You know, he was just kind of building his resume, if you will. His portfolio, I think is the more correct term, his filmography or whatever.
If he called it a CV, then it would be a JCVD CV.
Oh, that's good. Good one, Al. So the movie opens up in the past, 25 years earlier, in some part of Hong Kong. There's these upper-class parents. They kind of resemble Bruce Wayne's parents, and they have a bodyguard, Frank, who's following them in you know, his car. He's a very diligent bodyguard, but the parents insist that Frank takes the night off. Just as he takes off, the parents are attacked by the triads.
Right, because what the parents did before this attack is they opened up a tunnel that connects Hong Kong to mainland China. And there are several tunnels in real life that connect Hong Kong to mainland China. There's one that opened in 1972. So it's not like it's an original concept or an idea that this would exist. But apparently in this movie, it's a really, really big deal that now there is this tunnel and they are going to somehow make a ton of money on this tunnel. They don't say how, through tolls or what, but somehow this is a profitable thing. And the rich parents had a business partner who is now trying to kill them. All of these goons show up at the house. They kill the father. They kill the mother. They're about to kill the babies when Frank is able to save them. There's like a nanny who takes one of the babies, brings it to an orphanage, just kind of leaves the baby on the doorstep, rings the doorbell, and runs off. Frank takes the other baby, runs off into the woods, and then we flash forward 25 years to modern day Los Angeles, where one of the brothers, Chad, he's working at some kind of gym, flirting with all of the women who go there. He does his trademark Jean-Claude Van Damme split, but it's not like in a cool fight scene. It's just like, hey, ladies, look at what I can do.
This is, I guess you could call it the clean cut look. He wears nice Los Angeles outfits. But I have a question. How did the son of British parents, because those parents in the opening scene, you know, they were, you assume some kind of British expatriates or something living in Hong Kong. And he's raised in America by an American in Los Angeles. So how come he has a Belgian accent?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that most sons of dead British expatriates in Hong Kong who were raised in Los Angeles by an American learn how to speak English by watching Belgian movies. I mean, that's like the old cliche, right?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if you get a nanny that just plays nothing but Belgian movies, that's just, you know, you're asking for trouble.
I guess. But Frank pretty quickly tells Chad that they need to go to Hong Kong. The reason why is because someone has found the brother, who we know is Alex, in Hong Kong and shows him a picture. And then Frank's like, Chad, we need to go to Hong Kong. Trust me. He doesn't tell him why. He doesn't bother with any of the details. Just, we need to go to Hong Kong. And Chad's like, yeah, sure.
So when they arrive in Hong Kong, they go to this really shady bar and Chad goes in and all these women are going up to him like, hey there, welcome back. Here's a drink and giving him money. And he's like, oh, man, like Hong Kong's the greatest place ever.
Yeah, he really should know that something's wrong, but he's apparently an idiot. He is like lured into the back room by this gorgeous woman, Danielle, and she sticks her hand down his pants. And then Alex, the twin brother, comes in and says like, hey, what are you doing? He knocks Chad out. He refers to him as the F word because Chad is wearing black silk underwear, which to me just kind of sounds comfortable.
But it's like what a Los Angeles person would wear, I guess.
Oh, okay. And from there, Frank finally lets Chad in on the whole you have a long lost twin brother thing, which I was a little confused about this because apparently Alex's real name was always Alex. So how did he keep that name when he was dropped off at an orphanage and just like left on the doorstep? Like, how did they know his name was Alex?
That's an excellent point, Al. I have no idea.
Right?
But the only thing you could assume is that the note that was left with him said his name is Alex.
But there was no note. Maybe it was like written on his pajamas or something. There's a totally innocuous line that made me gag where during this Frank explaining everything scene, he's asking about Griffiths, who is the rich business partner of their parents who turned on them. And he says something like, have you ever heard of Griffiths? And I forget if it's Alex or Chad, but one of them says, that's like asking a New Yorker if they've ever heard of Donald Trump, which just kind of made me barf in my mouth. Although, as you learn in this movie, Griffiths is a notorious scumbag and criminal. So I guess it was kind of appropriate. I think at the time they just meant it as, a well-known rich guy.
Yeah, that's an interesting pickup. I actually didn't even notice that line.
Oh, okay. Maybe I just have highly attuned Donald Trump makes me gag radar. It's a distinct possibility.
Or maybe it was I didn't understand Jean-Claude Van Damme at that moment. Donald Trump.
That could definitely be. But Chad seems to be like on board with going after these guys and getting revenge for their parents. Alex is like, I kind of don't really care about that. He's also got like this side hustle, or maybe it's his main job, where he like smuggles Mercedes and cognac and cigarettes to people in Hong Kong. He brings Frank and Alex along for one of these jobs, and the Hong Kong police show up, so Alex has to beat up all of the guys that he's doing business with, makes them jump into the water, and then they're like in this really slow-mo boat chase away from the Hong Kong police that I couldn't help but feel like was really anticlimactic. Like, it's just not an exciting sequence.
Oh, absolutely not. And it ends when Chad decides to release the stolen Mercedes into the ocean. And then Chad and Frank fire their machine guns at the gas tanks, I assume. They blow up, or they just kind of go on fire. And the boat, it seems to be stopped by this. I mean, there's an entire sea that they could drive around these boats. But for some reason, you know, this fiery Mercedes, that's it. We can't stop it. We're Hong Kong Coast Guard or police or whatever. We can't stop this. We can't chase these fishermen.
I mean, that's a good point. Like, the Hong Kong Coast Guard is very easily thwarted. I don't know why they couldn't just, you know, turn left or right. Or I guess it would be port or starboard, right, if it's on a boat?
Port is left.
Oh, I never remember that.
Well, I remember because port and left both have four letters.
Oh, that's a good nautical tip there, James. Thank you.
Yeah.
But shortly after this scene, for whatever reason, Chad is just like standing on the streets of Hong Kong. And conveniently, Zhang, who's the head of the triads, he happens to drive by and kidnaps Chad, thinking that it's Alex, and basically is like, "You work for me now." But Chad is like, "No, I don't want to," because he's a nice guy, I guess. The head henchman, who is this guy named Moon, who we saw in the earlier scene that like Frank shot at him and didn't kill him, but he kind of messed up his eye and messed up his face. Moon like beats the crap out of Chad, very clearly is trying to knock him into this cargo container, which he does. And then for whatever reason, Zhang decides to allow Chad to live and like just dumps him into the street, which doesn't make any sense. Like, if he's a ruthless crime lord and Zhang said to him, "Hey, you better come work for me," and Chad says, "No, fuck you, go fuck yourself," shouldn't he kill him? Like, isn't that like the rule?
I think that he thinks that this is Alex.
He does, but so what? Shouldn't he still kill him?
Yeah, I mean, I guess he wants to recruit Alex because he knows Alex is kind of a scumbag. But once Alex says no, I don't know why they don't kill him. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, that's going to be a recurring theme throughout this movie, when people really should stop to kill the guy that they're enemies with and they just kind of don't for no reason. Also, there's this random non sequitur where they announce that Danielle works for Griffiths and she thinks that he's a very reputable, nice, great guy, but they're telling her that he's not. And Alex is like, "Just try to spy on him." And she's like, "Yeah, okay, sure." There's a scene where she's trying to like go through some files. And then there's a mysterious bodyguard that works for Griffiths, who is this beautiful woman named Kara, who threatens Danielle, but Danielle's like, "I think I got away with it. Oh, and by the way, Griffiths and Zhang are going to be at this nightclub tonight. You should go." Which also, though, just by the way, if she knows that Griffiths is hanging out with the leader of the triads, shouldn't that be a red flag that he's not really a saint like she seems to think he is? Honest businessmen don't hang out with the leader of the triad, right? That should be a warning sign.
Well, to be honest, Griffiths and people like him probably donate hospital wings in addition to all the bad things they do. Bernie Madoff was a huge philanthropist, so you could easily work for him and just be absolutely enamored by all the people that he's helped. You know, you might not know all the sides of him. So I do believe someone could be completely fooled. I think we could see that right now. People can be fooled by people's appearances.
I guess there's a obligatory action scene at Zhang's drug lab. They know about this drop because that was the job that Zhang wanted Alex to do when he thought he was talking to Alex when it was really Chad. So they blow it up. They fight some bad guys. Then they end up at Zhang's club and there's more shootouts and fighting and explosions and kicks to the face and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And there's something that I have noticed in all of these 90s films ever since our friend Darren from Board Games Are for Losers. He pointed out that when people hold two pistols, and that's a really badass thing to do because you could have twice the firing power, but they often seem to fire them one at a time, which is really no faster than just firing the same gun over and over and over. And once again, Jean-Claude Van Damme does the same thing where instead of firing two guns at the same time and having like double the cannon, he does this weird thing.
It's dumb. There's a lot of like slow-mo in these scenes. In the nightclub scene, one of them, I forget if it's Alex or Chad, takes a shot of whiskey and then smashes the glass with his bare hand, not like into a bad guy's head or something, just to like be tough. But like, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to smash glass in your hand for no reason and then have to go punch people?
This is one of those don't take, science and medical advice from Jean-Claude Van Damme's Double Impact.
I suppose not. There's another scene later on where Danielle is continuing to spy on Griffiths and Kara finds her again. And Danielle calls Alex looking for help, but Chad answers the phone because Alex and Frank are in the forest chopping wood for some reason. It's not really explained what the hell they're doing out there.
Chad.
Well, Chad is very concerned and he wants to go and help Danielle. He looks for the other guys for about half a second and then is like, I don't know where they are. I'm just going to go by myself, which is horrifically dumb because in all of these other scenes, he knows that he's not the best fighter. He knows that he needs Alex's help to beat up guys. He knows that he needs Frank to, at the very last second, shoot the guy who's got the gun on him. Like, that's happened a couple times in the movie. Like, he should have explored and tried to find Alex and Frank before going to get Danielle.
I would imagine that a place like this, where these guys are as prepared as they are, there'd be some air horn. You know, they don't have necessarily radios that could reach them, but an air horn or something that he could signal to them. It's completely ridiculous that the weakest of the three decides to go all out. But then again, this is the weakest of all of the Van Dams.
I guess. I mean, actually, to your point, in the opening scene, when their parents are talking to Frank and saying, go home, we're okay, they're communicating to him via walkie-talkies, like while they're driving, which is kind of funny, like, haha, back in the old days, they didn't have car phones. Although in this movie, too, in the present of 1991, they do have really big cell phones, like the Zach Morris huge brick cell phones. So yeah, there should be a way that they can communicate when the guys go off to chop wood.
Yeah, but you know, lo and behold, Chad's able to do it. Chad infiltrates the gang and he's able to bust Danielle out and he rescues her. But one little caveat, Al. Kara, the mysterious bodyguard of Griffiths, she is following them in a helicopter because once he escapes with Danielle, they go in a boat back to their, I don't know if it's an island or someplace off the coast of Hong Kong. I don't know where they are, but Kara has found them in a helicopter for some reason, just, you know, turns around.
Well, that one I actually do get because she wants to go and like get the whole triad army. I can understand that. Earlier in the movie, when they see all of the guys at the nightclub and they kind of look at each other and the good guys are like, oh, there's the bad guys we want to kill. Better run away. Like, wait, what? And even the bad guys are like, oh, there's the good guys we want to kill. Better not do it yet because it's only an hour into the movie. Like, what? Like, this is a good opportunity for you to go after these guys, and they just shrug their shoulders and don't. This time, I can kind of see why Kara's like, we're going to come back with an army.
Well said, Al. I now understand Kara's plan.
It makes sense, kind of.
It does. Meanwhile, Alex, still at the hut, he doesn't know where Chad is, he doesn't know where Danielle is, so he starts drinking. Now, this is it's such a ridiculous, gratuitous sex scene because it's an imagined gratuitous sex scene.
Right. The characters themselves are not having sex. Chad is fantasizing about what it would be like to have sex with Danielle. Meanwhile, Alex is paranoid and thinking, oh my God, I bet Danielle is having sex with Chad. So they're both kind of having the same fantasy / vision thing, but it's not real. It's not happening. In actuality, Danielle is downstairs in the boat, like changing, while Chad is driving to the island and Alex is drinking himself silly.
Wow, I'm so glad we actually get to delve deeper into this film because I interpreted this scene completely different, Al.
Oh?
Yeah, I think that Alex, he really wants Danielle. And I think that the entire sex scene is in his mind. He's getting drunk and in his mind, Chad is fucking her and he's so jealous. But they keep showing Chad is being nothing but a gentleman to her on the boat and just bringing her home, and he rescued her. And I think the whole thing is just Alex's paranoid fantasies, and he's like, motherfucker! And he throws the glass bottle into the wall. It shatters. And when Chad brings Danielle home, oh boy, do he and Alex get into a tussle?
Well, yeah, and that's sort of like the thing that you're waiting for, is to see Jean-Claude Van Damme fight Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Sort of like Superman 3 when Superman fought Clark Kent, right, Al?
I guess. I mean, it's just a lot of like, watch me fight a body double who kind of looks like me. But before it's Van Damme versus Van Damme, Alex slaps Danielle across the face. Remember, she didn't do anything wrong. It's just that Alex is drunk. And remember, Alex is one of the heroes of this movie who hits his girlfriend because he's drunk and paranoid.
Oh, absolutely. It's so odd that they would put this in the film and not, you know, address it somehow that he's an alcoholic and he apologizes and this is the worst thing, and that he later, you know, takes a bullet for her to show, you know, it's a kind of redemptive arc. No, it's just kind of like, Alex, you can't do that. And the boys like roll around and, you know, do some kickboxing on each other before Frank breaks it up. That's it. It's never addressed again. And you're absolutely right. Both of these boys, except for that scene, are kind of both equally the heroes of this film.
Right. I think you're supposed to like Chad a little bit more. But yeah, Alex is still one of the Van Dams that you're rooting for.
And, you know, the idea of having one character play two roles, it's obviously intriguing. And I would have to imagine for an actor, the idea is pretty cool. I mean, yes, Chad is your good old boy. He's a nice boy from Los Angeles. He's the handsome one, well-dressed, and he does the martial arts, doesn't really use the guns as much. And then you have the brother Alex, and you could have had something deeper in a Van Damme film of maybe this guy's a scumbag, your twin. But no, it's just they both kill bad guys together.
Yeah, it's not great. But after this big fight, Chad and Alex like kind of storm off to opposite sides of the beach. They pass out, and then Kara brings the whole triad army, which was her plan. They capture Frank and Danielle, don't kill them. They just want to hold them as hostages for some reason. Alex and Chad are able to get a few of the bad guys along the way, but most of the triad guys leave after they kidnap Frank and Danielle. But Alex and Chad get one hostage. They say, oh, he's going to talk. He's going to tell us where they took them. We don't see the interrogation scene, but eventually Chad and Alex show up on Griffiths or Zhang's boat, which is where Frank and Danielle are being held, and they start beating up bad guys in the attempt to rescue their friends.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this totally looks like one of those Sega Genesis Streets of Rage boards where they're on the boat and they're just kind of beating up bad guys. It's the formula of these films. Danielle and Frank, they are tied up and the bad guys are kind of taunting them over the PA system. They tell the boys that they're going to execute Frank if he doesn't talk. And Frank's like, don't listen to them. Don't listen to their tricks. And then, boom, there's a pistol fire. And, you know, you assume Frank is dead. And the boys are, no! And for some reason, it was a fake execution of Frank. Is there any reason they kept Frank alive?
No, there is not a single reason. Keeping him alive serves them no purpose. I could maybe see if they wanted to really bring them to where they were, which is what Griffiths seems to want. He's like, good, let them come to us. He could say, okay, I'm going to shoot him in the leg just to hear him scream more. That I could see if that's their end game. But to just pretend that they kill him but not kill him, there is no logical reason for that at all.
No. And the boys are fighting deeper and deeper in the ship, and they split up. And now it's kind of time for the boss battles.
Right. And so there is a rematch between Chad and Moon. And Moon is basically picking up all of these barrels and throwing them at Chad. And I could only think of Donkey Kong, just the way he's like picking up the barrels and throwing the barrels, and Chad is like kind of dodging the barrels. It just felt really, really Donkey Kong-esque to me.
Oh, I mean, it just kind of looked like any of these ridiculous Double Dragon Streets of Rage kind of video games. But there's this weird trope in fighting films, like when you knock the bad guy completely on the ground, you kind of stand above him and you might say stuff like, why are you waiting there? Why aren't you beating him up while he's down on the ground and totally dazed? And the same way, he lifts up this incredibly heavy-looking barrel, but he does it like a deadlift. Like, it takes a good, like, 5 seconds while he's deadlifting this barrel. He's completely vulnerable, off balance. Like, it's ridiculous. There's so many stupid things about this fight. It's not choreographed very well.
No, it's really poorly choreographed. They just keep kind of going on opposite sides of the screen, and it's hard to track who's going where. It's very, very poorly done.
The bad guy in this film, the guy Moon, he's this actor Bolo Young. He was also the bad guy in Bloodsport. That was another Van Damme film. This guy is jacked, and he makes an awesome villain. I mean, like an awesome, like, you know, huge boss to get past. I thought he's well cast, but eventually he's defeated.
Well, he also dies in a very anticlimactic way because Chad, like, kind of accidentally knocks him into an open electric panel and he's electrocuted.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I can't really beat you, so I'm just going to kind of use an electric fence. Wah, wah.
Yeah, it's really lame. Alex is having his own boss battle with this guy who's kind of like got these things on his shoes that are sharp, and they kind of fight in silhouette, and that's kind of shot pretty well in terms of like the style where they're in like this pitch black room, and then eventually the bad guy like punches through a window or something, and then there's light everywhere, and then that kind of ruins his whole stealth maneuvers. I don't know. Like, it looks kind of cool, but it's also just sort of anticlimactic the way it ends.
Yeah, this scene is filmed very well. And this villain is actually kind of intriguing because he has sort of razor spurs on his heel. And we saw earlier, he would do a roundhouse kick to some guy's neck and he just slices their jugular. And it's kind of a cool villain martial arts move, I have to say. After he does kill him, somehow the room that the bad guy's in, after he's dead. It's about to explode, and Alex runs away at full speed, and right before it blows up, what is the safest way to guarantee that you will survive an explosion behind you? Just jump in the air, and the explosion will just carry you to safety. And that's what he does, and, you know, it carries him to safety.
Right, right. After that explosion, Griffiths and Zhang are told that the boys are dead. Alex and Jed are dead in the explosion, so they just leave Frank and Danielle in the boiler room tied up. Presumably, one of the henchmen is going to rape Danielle, but then Alex and Chad show up, and then Kara appears out of nowhere and starts fighting with Chad. And speaking of anticlimactic deaths, this is a really weird moment in the film because she is this like really tough woman and she's got these really powerful thighs. It kind of reminded me of Onatopp in the Bond movie GoldenEye, where she uses her thighs to like crush men to death. But the battle ends when Chad basically just grabs a knife and sticks it in her side and stabs her to death. And it's just really off-putting. Like, you get it that she's a bad guy and she should die, but it seems like it should have been more of an accident, or she just kind of like fell to her own death or something. But like him stabbing her in the side, it's just like, oh, that's just uncomfortable.
Or I thought this was a perfect opportunity for a really awesome martial arts showdown. You know, obviously she's going to lose, but kicking his ass in the beginning, that would be awesome. I mean, I think she was well cast. I kind of like this character, you know, for what it's worth. I thought it would have been kind of fun for her to get a few kicks in and, you know, kick his ass. And then, you know, he wins in kind of a gimmicky way, maybe. But just stabbing her, like, was incredibly anticlimactic. Like, you didn't have to see him, like, you know, be beating up a woman, but a knife, that character deserved better.
Yes, absolutely. But then speaking of more anticlimactic moments, Alex and Chad end up just chasing Zhang and Griffiths. And keep in mind, Zhang and Griffiths killed their parents 25 years ago. These are old dudes. And so it's just like chasing these old guys around a dock somewhere. Zhang climbs up this crane and locks a door, and Alex has to like kind of climb around it, which I guess is intense, kind of, but like not really. He just beats up an old guy and then throws him off a crane.
Well, not before the old guy is like, I'll give you everything. Wait, he doesn't say that. He actually says, wait, if you don't kill me, I'll give you half.
Right, right. I mean, okay. Then there's Chad chasing down Griffiths. Griffiths, like, seems to get a forklift, and he's holding a cargo container, which he's threatening to drop on Chad. Chad is able to push Danielle against a different container where she won't get crushed somehow. We don't really see how. But then he jumps into the water, and then Griffiths is, like, firing his gun into the water. Somehow, off-screen, Chad gets out of the water, goes around to the forklift that was holding the container, takes control of it, and then he drops the cargo container on Griffiths, which is kind of cool. Like, how did he escape? How did he manage to do that? I have no idea. It happens off screen.
It's just a ridiculous, like, deus ex machina. I mean, there's a twin. Why didn't you have the twin do it? I mean, it's the most obvious answer. It's so stupid.
Yeah, yeah. But then Frank shows up and is like, hey, I'm not dead. Cool. And the movie ends with Chad giving like the okay sign. It's a freeze frame. And then there's a machine gun sound effect. For no reason. And at first I was like, wait, is that like another bad guy was lurking somewhere and he has a machine gun and it's not really over? No, it's over. It's just like there for effect, I guess. I don't know. It was very, very weird. Then over the credits, there is a god-awful song. It's called Feel the Impact. It's by an artist named Jen, G-E-N, who I never heard of, but it's basically just like feel the impact of my soul. Like, what the fuck? There is no soul in this movie at all.
Oh, I mean, it's such a jock jams kind of song. I mean, that would have totally fit on that album.
No. The jock jam songs were better songs than this garbage.
This would have been like Jock Jams Volume 3.
No, maybe 33. Like, now that's what I call Jock Jams Volume 33. I don't know how far they got in Jock Jams. I think they had, like, at least a couple of decent ones, I think.
They had a few. But, you know, I read that they actually tried to make a sequel to this film for years, but no one knows who has the rights to it, and there will never be a sequel to this film. So, you know, two Van Dammes in one film, that's all we're getting. But I actually have to say, this is not the first film that we saw two Van Dammes in it. Actually, Time Cop had two Van Dammes in the same scene. But this, I think, will be the final movie where there are two Jean-Claude Van Dammes in one scene. So Alan, as the final, you know, double Van Damme flick, does Double Impact stand the test of time?
Well, I mean, let's talk about the things that don't stand the test of time first. They refer to Hong Kong as a colony early in the movie, which, of course, it was. Now there's a lot of political unrest in Hong Kong, and, you know, China is foregoing the whole one country, two systems thing. They have taken Hong Kong's independence. There's just a lot of, like, political turmoil with Hong Kong right now. That doesn't stand the test of time. I guess, like, the really big blocky cell phone, that's the only other thing that doesn't stand the test of time. When you think about it, this movie is really, really smart in a lot of ways. You know, they have two characters played by Jean-Claude Van Damme. One of them has puffy hair, but the other one has slick back hair. So, you know, I don't like to throw this word around lightly, but it's kind of genius. Like, I don't know how they came up with that, but this is a real marvel of modern filmmaking. I'm not sure if you could tell, James, I'm being sarcastic.
I thought you were being, I think the word is facetious.
That's how you would pronounce it. It's facetious. Facetious.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this movie is really, really terrible on every level. By the way, for a quote-unquote martial arts movie, there's a ton of guns, but nobody can shoot. Like, it is comically bad how these bad guys are firing their guns at Chad and Alex from feet away. They are so, so very close, and they can't hit anyone at all, ever. Chad and Alex can shoot the bad guys, but after that first scene where they kill the parents, the bad guys are not able to hit anyone with any bullets at all throughout the rest of the movie.
That's absolutely true.
You know, it's like a joke that the stormtroopers in Star Wars can't hit their targets. Like, these guys make the stormtroopers look like expert marksmen. Also, just like the whole plot thing about the tunnel, that this is like Chad and Alex's birthright. It's never really addressed of, like, are they going to get the rights to the tunnel? What do the rights to the tunnel mean? Are they going to be rich now? How does that work? Do they want that money? How do they get that money? Like, you don't need a ton of exposition about, like, paperwork at the tunnel licensing office or whatever, but something. Like, there should be some kind of plan, or it should just be revenge, pure and simple. But they're kind of making it seem like it's both, and it just doesn't really make a ton of sense. The dialogue is awful. The gratuitous nudity is extra gratuitous because it takes place in a dream sequence. The fact that Alex hits his girlfriend and it's not addressed and they're happily ever after at the end, it's just terrible on, like, multiple levels. It does not stand the test of time, not even a little bit, at least in my opinion. What do you think, James?
Well, you know, there's some good parts of the film. I think parts of it are very well shot. We talked about some of the silhouette fights. I think the few parts that are martial arts, I think, are pretty good. I think it's well cast. I mean, this is prime Jean-Claude Van Damme. The guy that plays Moon, the guy Bolo Young, like I said, he's awesome. Danielle, she's played fine. And Frank, he's played by this guy Jeffrey Lewis. I think he does a very good job in it. I think you know, the side characters actually act better than I would imagine in a Jean-Claude Van Damme film. But the screenplay, I mean, did you notice in the credits that it's one of those, like, there were four people that wrote the screenplay?
Yeah, one of whom is Jean-Claude Van Damme himself.
Yeah, and you know, I have no problem with Jean-Claude Van Damme writing part of the screenplay or writing it himself. I mean, Sylvester Stallone wrote Rocky, but this is not the kind of film where four different ideas came together as one great idea. And I think the problem is that this film had to have been something else at some point because it really doesn't know whether it's a gun film or a martial arts film. Even when Alex or Chad, whichever one is fighting Moon at the end, when he sees this huge imposing guy lifting up a barrel, he reaches behind him to see if he has a pistol in his waist. And, you know, that was kind of funny with Indiana Jones when he did it in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I don't want to see him just, like, shoot the guy, but that's kind of what they do with a lot of these people. And, you know, they do the 80s action film thing where anyone can snap anyone's neck and it's, you know, they're dead. You know, I haven't seen many of the Jean-Claude Van Damme films. Like, I don't think I've seen Kickboxer or Bloodsport, but at least those, I think, have more straight-up martial arts. This had more of, like, an action feel, and I think Van Damme was probably trying to consciously go from straight-up fighting to more the Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger stuff, which is what he did in Time Cop and Sudden Impact and or Sudden Death, and he did a John Woo film, actually. This film, unfortunately, this does not stand the test of time. It's just got too many problems. There's a couple good parts to it. Yeah, there's a lot of potential with a double Van Damme, a double character, and I think the opportunity is squandered.
I mean, the fact of the matter is giving Van Damme more to do as an actor doesn't really work. I mean, he doesn't speak great English. He's hard to understand. And you're trying to make him as these two separate characters where Chad's more of like the soft-spoken nice guy and Alex is the rough and tumble, dirty down guy. But like, they're both Jean-Claude Van Damme. This isn't like Van Damme doing serious theater or anything.
Right, but one is raised in Hong Kong, one is raised in Los Angeles, and they both have Belgian accents. I mean, even Lindsay Lohan in The Parent Trap, like, made one of the twins have a British accent. You know, just do something with it. And I think you could do a lot with very little dialogue to make them actually have some characterization. The fact that there's one woman in this film and two brothers that probably are, you know, sort of into her, I think you could do a lot with that. But, you know, there's absolutely nothing here.
No, there is not. So that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we've got a very special guest coming on the show, your sister.
Yay!
We should specify your sister, Joanna, because we've had your sister, Amanda, on the show as well.
That's right. They were both on when we reviewed Billy Madison.
Right. What movie is Joanna coming on the podcast to talk to us about this time?
It's a sort of indie film called The Gods Must Be Crazy. Have you ever heard of this film, Al?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. But I will watch it for next week.
And maybe you'll be charmed, like I was. I was definitely charmed by this film as a kid. So join us next week when we find out whether The Gods Must Be Crazy stands the test of time.
Indeed. And in the meantime, talk to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at Test of Time Pod. We want to know your thoughts about Jean-Claude Van Damme and triads and tunnels from Hong Kong and fights with barrels and things like that. So let us know your thoughts. We always love hearing from you. And we'll see you next time, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.